Blog Talk Radio.
Educational Services and the SRI Label Group present Wild World on this magical network, Blog Talk Radio, from deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map. This is Larry Batson inviting you to join us for the next hour for fun and education with Dr. Henry Day on Wild World. Now, the SRI Label Group and Wildlife Educational Services present Larry Batson's Wild World. Hello, everyone, from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson on this magical network we call Blog Talk Radio. And great fun it is, especially when I'm operating the music. And from the Wild World News headquarters in Indianapolis, Indiana, though recently renovated, and I've heard with this beautiful knotty pine, the honorable, distinguished, and always prompt, Dr. Henry Day. Good evening, Doctor.
Good afternoon, Mr. Batson. Hey, you're Larry the Animal Guy. I saw you on TV.
Yeah, that's... Well, that's true. If anybody would like to enjoy the clip, all you have to do is Google Stephanie Mead, M-E-A-D, with an alligator, and she was the weather girl. And Dr. Day, I think it's had close to 18,000 views. Unbelievable.
Isn't that incredible? I got to see a little bit of it myself.
Yeah.
That was a very pretty cute alligator you had with you.
Oh, it is. That's Hector, and he's part of our junior education programs. You know, I like to work with the bigger alligators because it makes me seem like I'm more of a jungle guy. But they had they're renovating the television set so we don't have as big an area. And the newscaster, Phil Sanchez, how do I put this? He's kind of a weenie when it comes to animals. So, I know that if I took a 3 or 4 foot alligator in there, there's just not quite enough room, and he would not do well at all. But yeah, it's a lot of fun, lots of fun. Now,
our viewers should see the clip because it is rather humorous. It's had that many hits.
Yeah, all they have to do is Google Stephanie Mead and alligator, M-E-A-D. And it will come up, absolutely.
Well, if I had my opportunity, I would lunge at the weather girl, too.
Yeah, I know.
All right.
Now, from the Wild World News Studios in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hard to believe, once again, he's done it all. He's put it all together, everybody. The Wild World News with the honorable, distinguished, always prompt, Dr. Henry Day. Good evening, Doctor.
Good evening. Well, I want to tell you all, it is 84 degrees here in Indianapolis. It looks like we got some dark clouds moving in from the northwest, moving southeast. I expect some rain here in just a little bit.
We need a little bit of rain. Of course, my lovely wife Cheryl's out mowing the grass as we speak. And this spring, the grass has been growing quite quickly. But she has this big, powerful zero-turn cub cadet. And don't get in her way when she's mowing the grass. And she has the biggest smile on her face when she mows the grass that she will not let me touch. And I've talked about this before. She will not let me touch the mower, the weed whacker, anything.
It's
every time
best
I do that. Yeah, I agree. So what do we have for the Wild World tonight, Doctor?
Well, we're going to start out with some old news. An 8-million-year-old elephant has been found in Macedonia. Now, paleontologists are excavating the remains of a prehistoric elephant found there in Macedonia. Now, the scientists estimate the animal would have weighed about 10 tons and would have been about 50 years old at the time of death. Yeah, roughly 80 million years ago. Now, that is twice the size of an adult male African elephant.
My gosh. I would like to have seen that, though. I would like to have seen that.
All right, now for our listeners on the East Coast, the sea turtles are showing up at Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Now, wildlife officials have reminded people that they will suffer stiff penalties if they disturb the sea turtles while nesting.
Well, they should. They should leave the little turtles alone.
Yep, the turtles have been coming there a lot longer than we have.
Yeah, and people, I know some people think they're actually helping the little turtles, but usually it's more harm than good, so.
Yeah, and wildlife officials are very serious about this. Do not mess with the turtles. What's that
I'd
smell
be out
in
there helping
Florida?
Them. Yeah.
What's that smell in Naples, Florida, you ask? Well,
what is that smell? I'm sorry.
The red tide is killing fish along the Gulf Coast in Collier and Lee counties there. Not a good thing, not a good thing. This red tide moves in, cuts off all the oxygen, and thousands of fish die.
I can remember I had a friend that lived in Florida. I went down and spent a few days. I was down there snake collecting, which is what a surprise. And he talked about the red tide when that occurred, how devastating it was. Of course, he was quite the fisherman, and he loved the outdoors, and he's not with us anymore. God bless Don Waltz, but he lived in Bradenton, Florida. And, he talked about that quite a bit. That's Mother Nature. What can you do? There's a reason
that's
for everything.
I lived in Tampa, and I witnessed it a few times myself. Yeah, it's just nothing you can do about it.
No.
All right, now beware. A black bear has been spotted in trees and wandering along the streets of Ridgewood, New Jersey. So if you happen to be outside, just keep your eyes open. Also, in Springfield, Oregon, authorities are warning people to be on the lookout for a cougar that has been seen in the area.
Where was this at? I'm sorry.
Springfield, Oregon.
So cougars are supposed to live there.
But there, somebody's built houses, and we're not sure why, but people are living there. So keep your small animals inside.
Yeah. That's just too darn bad.
Out of Durham, North Carolina, Duke University says two lemurs were born at a facility there dedicated to the study and care of endangered mammals.
Very cool.
That is very cool. Now, you've worked with lemurs before.
That's right. We had ringtail lemurs for many, many, many years. Yes, absolutely. And they were... The problem when working and handling lemurs is they have the same expression on their face the entire time. So they're kind of hard to read. You know, they're more difficult to tell when they're upset or they have the same look all the time. My brother had that same look all the time. so it was like, and dear Cheryl, she was bitten by him so many times. As I've said, she's one of the best darn animal handlers in the entire country. So it's like.
Well, I agree.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I sure wouldn't bite her.
No, I wouldn't either. I've had to think about that.
You have a pet nickname for her, don't you?
Yes, it's called the bipedal wolverine. And it's. She's in the other room. I just heard a hey. She's go- She's going to be contributing in the near future a segment that might completely destroy my reputation. So she's going to be doing that in the future. So you got that to look forward to, Doc.
Good. Yeah, that's great. I love it when she's on the airwaves.
I do too.
All right, the mating season is going on across the United States. The animals are on the move, so beware. In Cle Elum, Washington, two separate rollover crashes involving elk resulted in closing the interstate there for hours.
Mm.
So everything is on the move now, all the way from amphibians all up to the giant mammals. So please beware when you're out there.
Well, I have the old story. We were in Rocky Mountain National Park. This is 45 years ago, and we were there in the spring when the elk were coming down from the tundra. And they were everywhere, and we were going down this road one night, and this motorcyclist goes flying around us, and I'm thinking, God, he's just an idiot. Sure enough, we got down the road maybe another quarter of a mile, and there he was sprayed all along the highway, and we kind of picked him up and hauled him to the cabin that his parents had rented for their vacation. The elk died. He didn't know what he'd hit. He thought he'd hit a brick wall, and So their vacation was kind of ruined after that, but he was okay. I mean, he was just kind of scraped up and could have been a heck of a lot worse, but yeah, that was, you got to watch out for the critters, you know, this time of the year. Everything, like you said, after a long, hard winter, they're on the move.
Yep, and just beware when you're out there. Now, Bismarck, North Dakota. I'm not crazy about this, but it goes on every year. Paddlefish snagging season has started.
Wow.
So if you want to snag something, go snag a cousin or an aunt or something. Don't be snagging paddlefish.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, now this next story is a little confusing to me. Toledo, Ohio. Officials have voted to make Toledo more butterfly-friendly by removing milkweed as a noxious weed under the municipal code. Now, as far as I know about butterflies, monarch butterflies love the milkweed, don't they? Isn't that their main food course?
Yes, it is. I believe you gave me that factoid.
I'm confused by this. We'll do a follow-up on this and try to let you know next weekend what's going on. All right, we've got a mad cow in Houston, Texas. A deputy constable who stopped to assist motorist involved in an accident was chased around his patrol car by a cow. Now, the cow ran off. The cow ran off, and the deputy wasn't hurt. But he stopped to help some people on the road and get chased by a mad cow.
I wondered if there's a video involved with that.
That's exactly what I was wondering. I would love to see that.
Yeah. I might watch it more than once.
All right. Paris, South Dakota. Authorities say the cold winter will hurt pheasants and prairie grouse hunting will be delayed. Because the start of the nesting season was delayed this year. So go to the store and buy some food and stop hunting pheasant and grouse.
Yeah. Go buy a chicken.
Hey, have the hummingbird.
Of course, the chickens are not happy about me saying that, but.
I know.
Yeah,
have the hummingbird showed up at the place yet?
I have to tell you, Dr. Day, I set the hummingbird feeders out and. Within 10 minutes, we had hummingbirds, and we were late because really you're supposed to set them out tax time, April the 15th, for this part of the country, and we just forgot, and my wife Cheryl said, hey, we need to get the hummingbird feeders going, so I went back to the barn and got them out and cleaned them and filled them with the sugar water, and I'll give you a little secret on that sugar water, 3 parts water, 1 part sugar. Some people say 4 parts water and 1 part sugar. No, no, no. If you make it a little sweeter to those hummingbirds, it's like heroin. And We did, Dr. Day. I couldn't believe it. Within 10 minutes, there was one. And I hadn't seen any because you usually hear them buzzing around in the woods and stuff, and I had not. Yeah. So.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so that made my whole week.
That's what I'll be doing later then, filling up the hummingbird feeders.
Yeah. That's right.
All right. Well, have we got Harvey yet?
Yes, we do.
Good afternoon, Harvey.
Oh, I don't have him on yet. Here, hang on. I've got this all figured out. Are you done with the Wild World News?
Yeah, we'll close it up. We're going to go next to who's gotten older this past week, so Harvey can play.
Oh, well, let me get him on here. Absolutely. Here, hang on. Now we have Mr. Kubernick.
Good afternoon. You're in Indianapolis, I seem to remember.
Dr. Day is in.
Yeah.
May I also volunteer something? When I was a student at San Diego State University in the early 70s, one of my teachers proudly boasted that a former student of his was Joan Embry.
Joan,
do you
is
know
a
who
of
that
show.
Is?
Well, she's
Joan
been
Embry
on the show
was
a couple
the.
Times.
She was. Wasn't she? I know she wasn't she on your show, and does she still? She was the animal handler on the Johnny Carson show. Did she work at the San Diego Zoo for years?
She did, and
right.
She did the famous segment with the marmoset that urinated on Johnny's head.
Right, and I would imagine she'd be your perfect pinup girl for this radio show.
Well, she is.
That is correct.
You'd be rather offended by that.
I guess so. I guess you pin up, girl. I guess that's a Betty Grable riff. I'm sorry about that. But I'm just saying that was a pretty visible animal trainer handler. That was our real exposure to wonderful animals besides cats and dogs.
Well, and of course, our good friend Jim Fowler from the old Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom show.
Yes.
So we went out and did Carson 4 or 5 times with Jim. And took animals out. So
we might as well go bring
cool.
in Marlon Perkins while we're at it. So I'm right here for you.
I know. Hey, we wanted to participate because go ahead, Dr. Day. I'm sorry.
Well, it's time to play Who's Gotten Over this week, and I think Harvey's going to do good with this one. All right, Willie Nelson got a little older this week. How old is Willie, Harvey?
I would say he's maybe 84.
Well,
I'm thinking he's like 91.
Well, you're a little further out there. Harvey was closest. In fact, we're going to have to give it to him because he turned 85 this week.
Okay.
Oh, there we go.
I knew him as 84. Okay, that's good.
Yeah, there you go. All right, now singer Frankie Valli.
He turned 83. He just turned 83 because I know him.
He turned 84.
Okay, I knew him as 83. Okay, I forget we're dealing with a birthday. I'm giving you the time period before the actual clock rolls over. That's why I'm off a year, but I'm on the putting green.
Well, see, you're within a week, so you're good to go. You're fine.
Thank
All right,
you.
Christopher Cross.
Who?
Christopher Cross.
Oh, the singer, the Warner Brothers singer, Salem and all that?
Yeah,
he
right.
I would say he is 62.
Well,
I'm not even going to go there because I have not a clue.
He'd be between 62 and 64. But
Chris turned 67 May 3rd.
Right. Okay. He was a little. That means they cut his age a little bit when he got his record deal. Good move.
Yeah, make him look a little younger. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. May 2nd, Engelbert Humperdinck turned.
He would be, would he be 77?
Mr. Batson?
I don't know. I'll say 81.
No, he's not that old.
I don't
know. Well, Mr. Batson won this one. He turned 82 this week.
Wow.
Yeah.
Jerry Dorsey, real name.
Yeah. What's his real name?
Jerry Dorsey.
Yeah, that's pretty common. I can understand now why.
Okay.
Wow.
I'm not very good at ages since I kind of act like I'm 14.
Not me really either. All right. Judy Collins, one of my favorites.
Judy Collins could be she could be 77.
I'll say 75. I'll play the Price is Right trick.
Well, actually, Judy Collins turned 79 this week.
Yep.
Oh, Harvey wins.
Rita Coolidge.
Rita Coolidge is probably 76, maybe.
God, this is depressing, Dr. Day.
God, I mean, this is... Never asked
yeah,
a woman her age, but I mean, I'm volunteering 76.
Oh, I'll play prices right. I'll say 75.
Rita turned 73 this week.
Oh, I'm sorry,
oh,
Rita. Added a couple years.
I don't want
all
to be
all right. Funny. Let's do Bob Seger.
Whoa.
I have no idea.
75.
Rambling gambling man.
75.
I think Harvey's got it right on the money.
Well, pretty close. 73.
Okay.
Oh. And he's still rambling and gambling.
Do you remember the singer and comedian Lulu Roman from Hee Haw?
No, I don't.
Rather a large
I remember
girl.
Misty Rowe and Roy Clark from Hee Haw and Buck Owens, but no, I don't know this one.
Of course you would remember Misty. We all remember
yeah.
Misty.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Lulu turned 72 this week.
Okay.
Yeah, you shouldn't even have done that one, Dr. Day.
One of my favorites, Michael Palin with Monty Python.
Michael Palin could be 79.
Okay, I'll say, I think he's right. I think Harvey's got that one, hands down.
Michael only turned 75 this week. He'd be mad at you.
Wow, I'm adding years to people. It shows you how much I follow this stuff.
Well,
what's wild is
Harvey is the premier music historian, so the
my credibility has
something.
Kind of suffered because I didn't have the birthday thing together. I guess I should spend more time on Wikipedia.
Yeah, there you go.
I'm here to hawk books. Let's get the show on the road.
All right, let's do a couple more and we're out of here. Pia Isadora. Pia Isadora.
I think she's like 64.
I don't have any idea. I'm not gonna help this cause any.
Well, Pia Isadora turned 66 this past week on May 4th.
Okay.
All right, let's get out of here. Let me leave you with a couple of facts. If a bald eagle loses a feather on one wing, it'll shed a corresponding feather on the other to stay balanced.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very impressive,
also,
Dr. Day.
In the 1860s, Thomas Edison developed a device to electrocute cockroaches. Now think about that as you're falling asleep tonight. That's the Wild Wheel World News for May 6th.
Well, once again, thanks to Dr. Day for an amazing Wild World News. We'll also say the SRI Label Group is our underwriter for Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. The SRI Label Group is for people that love all music, rock, jazz, blues, country. It is all their artists and their classic recordings, Best of ELO, Little Richard Live, the Chambers Brothers, Hall & Oates, a catalog of thousands of recordings available for download or just to listen to. Explore amazing music collection at the best musical site, the SRI Label Group. Check it out. SRIRecords.com.
Yeah.
Larry Batson's Wild World Blog Talk Radio is so proud this week. We have what I consider the premier author and music historian all the way from Los Angeles, California, our good friend. Even still after that segment on how old are they, Harvey Kubernick. Good evening, Harvey. Nice to have you along with us.
Hey, Larry. How are you?
We're fantastic.
Yeah,
how's Harvey?
You're getting ready for football season with my quarterback from Stanford, ready to throw
yes.
the pig for you. We're all good.
Yeah, I'm telling you. Well, we're all good. And we're so happy that you've agreed to be a part of our Blog Talk Radio program. I'm very briefly going to go through some of the books that you, some of the most amazing books. Folks, this is rock and roll's premier historian. I mean, the books that he is, a complete rock and roll music history of the Summer of Love, A Perfect Haze, Monterey International Pop Festival. We have both of those books, absolutely unbelievable. Also on a copy, The Beatles Invade America and Hollywood. A tremendous book, Leonard Cohen. And as I'd mentioned to Harvey, I have a friend, which I loaned his copy of Neil Young by Harvey Kubernick, and this guy doesn't read. I mean, I've never known him to read. I've known him for 50-some years. And he said he sat down with that on a Saturday afternoon, and he did not let go of it until he read it from cover to cover. So that, to me, just shows you.
I'm just trying to raise the literacy rate in America.
You are.
Well.
Yeah.
I'm just doing the best
dream,
I can, but
Canyon,
you know, your friend and you and me and people listening, we're all just trying to serve the music and drive it. I am documenting it, and I know I'm sort of delivering some different and new angles with the thousands of interviews and the text writing and the layout. And you know, I think it's become a bit of a mission now. You find
mm-hmm.
your calling sometimes and you get on your path. And I know these recent books are really connecting with the uninitiated, the devoted, you know, disc jockeys, people like yourself who, you know, due to circumstance or fate or destiny, you know, people like you and I, like we actually saw, you know, Jimi Hendrix. We have
yes.
a bond by concerts we went to like 49 years ago. It's kind of a shorthand, and I think, you know, the people who plug into my books, most of them weren't born, let alone saw some of these, you know, legendary performers. But I think I bring them into that world. Plus, I know I'm bringing in a whole lot of new information, photos, artifacts that could only happen if I wasn't like the messenger. So, I mean, I'm really happy it's connecting with you and your audience and your friend and all that stuff.
Wow. Well, they're unbelievable. In fact, I was so proud. Well, I'm very proud. I consider Harvey a friend. But when I went to the mailbox Friday, we'd been up to Warsaw, Indiana, doing school programs, and we got in 5 or 6 o'clock, and I looked in that mailbox and I saw that big manila envelope and I knew what was inside of it, and I opened it up, and this is so cool. Dr. Day, here's the latest book, Harvey, The Doors, Summer's Gone. And what I'm telling you, there's not many pictures in this book. I mean, there's a lot of printed word. It's just, and I have to tell you, Harvey, last night I took it with me. We have a music night we do. We play instruments and so forth. And one of my friends there was a Doors fanatic. And I,
which means
well,
he grabbed it from you.
Oh, he did. He was leafing through it. And I told him, I said, well, I'll loan it to you, you know, next week or the week after. He said, oh, I'll read every word. He says, I love the Doors. So it's
what's kind of interesting when you do some of the assorted things I've done, and, you know, the work is turning into decades now. Don't ask me how. Thank you, God. But I think with this book, I really wanted the information and the data and some new views on the Doors as, like, the real focus of the book. And I did make a conscious effort, A, not to have any color photos inside the book, and B, to keep the black and white photos and artifacts, you know, to a minimum, because I really wanted the reader to have to be confronted with the text, the multi-voice, you know, interviews. And because Jim Morrison, especially, and the Doors they've been so widely chronicled, books, magazines, feature films, documentaries, and Jim, you know, at times was very telegenic, maybe we'll use that term, that I just wanted to have a vehicle, a print vehicle, a hard book where the reader had to read pages of words before they saw any kind of picture of the band or Jim Morrison. And I think that was a conscious decision made when assembling this book, because I know that I'm sort of, I'll use the word known, or get, you know, kudos or get acclaim for the visuals and the artifacts and the pictures that I find and coordinate and edit. But this book, I wanted the swing to be on the words and the voices of other people. And I think, you know, it's successful.
Well, it is. I can't wait to read it. I haven't had the opportunity yet, but just to hold it here, I'm excited. I told you a story. Jimmy Greenspoon, who was the keyboard player for Three Dog Night, you know, he played all the great parts, songs like Chess Fever and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And he told a story on our show. He and Jim Morrison were out for a night of liquid refreshments, and they were on Sunset Boulevard, and they'd been in, I don't know what bar they'd been in there, but let's put it this way, they were asked to leave, and as soon as they walked out the door, that barkeep called every bar on Sunset Boulevard and said, hey, if Greenspoon and Morrison show up, don't let them in. There.
Yes, that was the time where Jim usually became Jimbo.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was kind of the switch got turned. And there was a time on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood, or now called West Hollywood, where there were,
yeah,
really were a lot of restaurants and bars. And
yes.
And age limits were very important back then. I mean, there was a period in the late 60s. You couldn't be under 18 as a minor on Sunset Boulevard without a parent with you. And many friends of mine got busted or arrested for curfew violations. It was kind of a minor thing, but they didn't want children on Sunset Boulevard. So it was an adult playground. So Jim, and of course Jimmy, had a real good time.
Oh man,
I've heard those stories too. And that's the other thing about this Doors book. Jim Morrison is not painted as any kind of saint in these pages, but I kept the sex and the drugs, and especially the liquor, really down to a super bare minimum in this book, because I'd rather have more the spotlight on the words or the lyrics, the songs, the recording studios, and band members who've, like, knew Jim or shared the stage with the Doors in concert. And I think that's another, I'll use the word refreshing aspect, because
sure,
if you're looking for the ghoulish Doors demise story or the disembodied loner and, you know, death in Paris and all that sort of stuff, it really doesn't exist in this endeavor.
Well, I have to tell you, the artists, we've had several that are now members of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and one of the questions when the publicist talks to us about coming on the show is they'll ask about what we want to talk about. I tell them I'm not interested in anything dirty. That's not part of this program. I said I'm more interested in creation of music, the genius of the performers that we've had on, and that I think is much more interesting than hearing all, because who doesn't have a dark side? I mean, look at Dr. Day. My God, if a book ever comes out about him.
I was over at a production office, and there was an email came in front of me from a company doing a major documentary on a singer-songwriter's life. And the first line of the email said, as you look into your archives, we're especially looking for the dark stuff.
Oh.
And I hearken back to something Patti Smith told me in an interview, I don't know, about 12 years ago. I was talking to her the very moment in 2004, maybe, on the phone doing an interview with her. And I said, Patti, I just got my first book deal. And she said, that's terrific, Harvey, you know. And she said, and when it happens for you, kid, and you start talking to a bunch of people, especially this TV stuff and these documentaries and all that, and you talk to the radio folks, please don't give them a sob story. And she kind of cautioned me about things like appearing on Behind the Music and programs like that. And this is before social media exploded or real active tabloid journalism. And it's out there. It's fine. But I'm in a position, and I have to fight for this constantly in books that come out, the proposals that don't get made due to various machinations. Sometimes they're turned down out of economic concerns. Sometimes a publisher says this territory's been covered, and of course they all call me later. Why didn't you tell me the book would be like this? Well, you passed on it, you know. But the thing is, I just want to do what I want to do, and I want to write the people that I've either met or known or research, and I've got to bring something different to the table. And as I might have told you before, I'm not only bringing something new to the table, I'm bringing in a ton of furniture with me.
That's so true.
And the furniture includes other people's voices. That's not to say I haven't written books or liner notes in first person exclusively, you know, me. I like to bring people to the party with me. I like the multi-voice narrative aspect. I like talking to people and asking them to write a few paragraphs and setting that up and very carefully telling them a loose framework of what I'd like them to comment on and put that in a book. It's not lazy journalism. Everybody's cited, acknowledged, and I think you know, the witnesses are very important.
Well, they are, and I will have to say Harvey Kubernick is probably the hardest working writer of any subject there is, because I ask him, he's got one book coming out after the other. In fact, in a little bit we're going to talk about the Inside Cave Hollywood, which is, that cave is deep, I'll bet. It's, but we're going to talk about that.
Some people, maybe this looks like it's a parade of books coming out, but if you really want to know part of the secret, part of the secret is, when Jack Kerouac finally got On the Road published after, I don't know, 6 or 7 years at least, when the book came out, he had 5 other manuscripts or books ready to go, or portions of books ready to go. So the real secret of some of this avalanche, as somebody has told me, is these books began 10, 20, 30, 40, and 45 years ago. And for the last half century, I've just been working on them, whether it be conducting interviews. Think about starting on a typewriter with carbon paper as your copy backup. I think you know what I'm talking about. Okay, and for about 20 years, there wasn't too much of a market for the commodity of Harvey Kubernick as author, only because, and I think this is the prime reason, most of the book publishing world is based in New York. Harvey Kubernick is a proud native Angeleno, writing very regionally driven, you know, volumes. That's not going to fly with a New York mentality. So I never took the rejection and all that stuff and the stonewalling very personal, because I'm not going to be the L.A. guy that moves to New York to make it. What has happened because of the internet, I think, and also, and again, I don't need to psychoanalyze the reasons why. I'm just grateful and thankful these things are seeing the light of day, because for many, many years, I was the only person who believed in the themes and the topics and the navigation. But part of it was I happened to, shall we say, live in the classic rock era. That's not to say I haven't done three interviews with Ice Cube, and that I didn't interview disco artists. And I just interviewed yesterday Mike Garson, David Bowie's a piano player on 20 albums. I do it all.
Yeah.
However, if I'll use the word however, the assignments, the commissions, the interest, the contracts, because I'm negotiating myself without a literary agent, management, and the usual team that generates these things. People, there was a period where, this is before the internet really kicked in, a lot of people, and I'm talking about people in the publishing world, thought the things I wrote about, they were dinosaur people. I'm just bringing in the animal aspect to your show. These are relic people. These are dinosaur people. Who cares about the band? The Stones are old. Who cares about the Beatles and Hollywood? The Monterey Pop Festival was 44 years ago. And everybody was preoccupied getting their biographies out on rap artists or hip-hop, country rock, roots rock. And that's following glitter, glam, Britpop, disco. And when punk music showed up, or new wave, there was a whole contingency of the music media and pop culture reporting in general that really went out of their way to dismiss the people that I always listened to, collected, and wrote about. And, you know, in 1975, I interviewed Johnny Cash for Melody Maker newspaper, British Weekly, a million circulation at the time. I'm talking to Johnny Cash, and he's at a Christian booksellers convention in Anaheim, California, hawking his Man in Black book. He is literally about to be kicked off the Columbia Records label before he was sort of resurrected a little bit on Mercury Polygram, and then before this big renaissance courtesy of, you know, Rick Rubin and American Recordings. And punk rock writers, not everyone, and listen, I wrote liner notes to a Ramones album. I mean, you know, but the media got fascinated and preoccupied with the current sounds, which is part of the job. So all these people were mocked and laughed at, and then all of a sudden CDs started coming out in the mid-80s, and all of a sudden the internet starts going on where the archive gets circulated, and then all of a sudden satellite radio shows up, and all of a sudden the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame keeps getting more coverage constantly, and these people end up in museums, and they've been in my record collection. But more importantly, I was running tape on all these people. I never deserted Burton Cummings of the Guess Who, Robbie Robertson of the band. I could talk to him in 1976, and I could talk to him in 2017. I have this, like, 45-year wingspans with people. It's not a heroic Joseph Campbell-type journey, but it is a belief in the art and the music and the legacies of these people. And, ironically, the field was kind of left open to me, or the crack in the door was, shall we say, a little wider, because a lot of these people were deserted, or, oh, we've already had books on Leonard Cohen, we've already had books on Neil Young. No, but they weren't done by me. And all of a sudden,
that's right,
people started saying, let's see what he can do in an arena away from L.A. And I've done that. And now, another factor is I can't say I anticipated this. 10 years ago, well, in 2007, it's 11 years, I wrote a cover story for Mojo magazine in England Bob Marley was on the cover, too. On the 40th anniversary of the Monterey International Pop Festival, big feature. And I said to myself, there has to be a book on this one day. And a publisher showed up, and the book came out to celebrate a 45th anniversary in 2012. And I said to myself, I need to catch some of these 50th anniversary milestones, because all of a sudden rock and roll people or singer-songwriters or poets, in the case of Leonard Cohen, they're going to be hitting this world either where they're age 70 or 80. So these birthdays become really milestone events because the media is preoccupied with age. But all of a sudden, classic albums, I'm getting sick of that word classic. Let's just say the records we love and cherish. All of a sudden,
right.
I knew, and again, I'm not a genius to figure this out. Just look at the dates. I knew that there would have to be things like The Summer of Love of 1967, I knew could be a book in the summer of, 2017, because the music had durability and vitality. And it hit this 50-year mark, and we keep buying it on vinyl, CDs, streaming service, cassettes, downloading. We buy a lot of the same music over and over in new configurations. So I caught some of this 50-year anniversary wave, for lack of a better word. In the case of The Doors, I wanted to avoid the 50th anniversary thing because the band and their record label was having their own 50-year, ongoing renaissance with, singles, box sets coming out and unreleased stuff and DVDs. So I waited till the 50th anniversary of The Doors was over, and I knew I had a book on The Doors in me. And then what has gone on, swinging the subject over to we'll call it my first literary anthology, the collection of some of the work I've displayed on the Cave Hollywood website, www.cavehollywood.com. I've been writing on this website. I'm not a blogger. I don't really review records. I just am Harvey Kubernick, and I do what I want to do, and it finds an outlet. And after 10 years, I was approaching the 10-year mark of being kind of the editor of this website, sort of the Andrew Luck quarterback, the principal writer, and the owner of the website, a longtime friend of mine, David Kessel, said, I've been watching all this 25-year anniversary stuff and all these 50-year anniversary stuff. In Cave Hollywood, I've had a functioning pop culture portal for 10 years, and he was a guy very involved in the Internet when he was chairman of the board of IUMA, Internet Underground Music Association. He oversaw and put out the first collection of music from that was birthed online. He started something called Offline Records. But he was kind of a pioneer and still is in the digital domain. And he said, well, why don't we do something? And I said, my work is really good online because the word count, there's usually not a restriction when I do things online. So if you want to read 11,000 word essays on Elvis Presley's The Searcher movie, sometimes in print magazines you've got a 2,000 or 3,000 word limit. But I said, I know this stuff is really potent online because I check out some of the fan mail. I get stopped for people bring up articles to me. I know this can work in a book where we actually get to put the non-edited versions or some photos in and some of the articles that got truncated, if that's the term. And we put out a book that's out right now, Inside Cave Hollywood, available through Amazon, just like the Doors books on Otherworld Cottage Industries. But both titles you can find through Amazon, and they're filtering their way into two traditional, book outlets, and I'm very excited about both titles because, it's part of my saga. My life is wrapped up and so intertwined with the expedition, but I also know the books serve as a function, and I know that I steer the reader or the viewer to discover some music that they've forgotten about or rediscover albums and songs. But I also know I'm providing hundreds of new angles and insights into people that a lot of people think they know a lot about. And they do, but I had to find even more to not redefine the personalities, but just present a kind of a different avenue to dig as well.
Well, I've always said I'm so thankful to grow up when I did with the music that we were exposed to. It was a wonderful time in the 60s and 70s, from the Beatles to Hendrix to Led Zeppelin. I mean, the kids now, they just don't know what they missed. And
well,
it reminds me of the T-shirt
I saw in a market in Sherman Oaks, California, and the T-shirt said, "I may be old, but I saw all the cool bands."
I need that T-shirt, absolutely.
And listen, I make attempts to check out new music all the time, whether it be sampler discs or seeing people play. I mean, it's in my neighborhood. But I just find myself, re-examining or being brought back to this world because we're old enough, and as Ram Dass told me, getting older is groovy. I hope
right.
People can embrace that. We're not actresses freaking out hitting 30 or 40 and our work's diminishing. I mean, I know that exists in this ageist town. But we just showed up at a time period where there was probably 1/8 as many people. There was freeform FM radio. I mean, I point this out in my 1967 complete Rock History of the Summer of Love. There's a focus on radio in that book, pictures of disc jockeys from the AM and the FM dial. But as seminal as the internet has been as a teaching tool or a communication device, when the world went from AM radio to FM freeform underground rock radio, sort of let's just say 67, it was kind of late 66, the game changed. It was kind of like football in America all of a sudden adopting Canadian football rules, which are 3 downs instead of 4, and a field that's 110 yards long instead of 100 yards long. It was a wider playing field. And you remember hearing your music on FM radio. It's why you saw Jimi Hendrix play in your hometown, or later Jethro Tull. The floodgates really did open, and people like you and I'm sure some of your listeners, we do not forget the contributions of Bo Diddley, Chuck Berry, Little Richard, the Everly Brothers, or even Elvis Presley. Without them, there's no game whatsoever.
That's right. Our guest, Harvey Kubernick, God bless Harvey, but also we want to say God bless to Shelley Leibowitz and the SRI Label Group for underwriting Wild World. So we're back on the air. It's very, very exciting. One of the members of his extensive catalog is a tremendous artist, Ray Brown. We're going to take a short break. Here's a little Ray Brown on Wild World on Blog Talk Radio.
Loving, kissing, and a hugging. this new girl in the whole world that can love me like you do.
Streets are uneven when you're down. when you stray. No one remembers your name when you stray. When you stray. When you're straying. All right, yeah. When you're
our guest, Harvey Kubernick, he's written a wide variety of books from Neil Young, The Beatles, Leonard Cohen, and his latest on The Doors, Summer's Gone. He's a rock encyclopedia, and talking with him is like a musical journey from Laurel Canyon to Liverpool. Our guest, Harvey Kubernick.
Hey, it was
Harvey,
really
so
cool
to
hear that. It was really cool to hear that Ray Brown thing, and I know there's a lot of jazz on that label that's available, but just
oh,
to show you... Just to show you, I know the wonderful trumpet player Sarah Kramer talks about music and life and connecting the dots. I still kind of feel it's more there are no accidents, which Andrew Lou Goldham always stresses to me. But here you are out of nowhere pulling this Ray Brown track, okay? And I was just talking to David Kessel about Ray Brown, the guy that owns the Cave Hollywood website, because his father... jazz icon, producer, band leader, guitarist Barney Kessel, did dozens and dozens of dates with Ray Brown, you know, Playboy Jazz Winter Poll kind of albums and all that. And in The Doors book, I stressed the jazz needle that hooked The Doors up. There's a long interview with the drummer, John Densmore, talking about the jazz influences in The Doors and people that he would see at clubs in Hollywood. And so I was just talking to David literally about Ray Brown because we'd see him on TV a lot. I think he was married to Ella Fitzgerald toward the end or for a while or a long time. But and I said, when was the last time you saw Ray Brown? This is before you just played this record. And he said, you know, it has to probably be about, you know, 20 years ago I was in Santa Monica, California, and I noticed Ray was playing at a club called Loa in Pico and Santa Monica Boulevard. And I thought maybe I'd just kind of bop in. I hadn't seen Ray since I was, you know, 18, because these are family friends, the Kessels and the Browns, because they, you know, they'd be in Lake Tahoe together for Sammy Davis Jr. shows or Ella Fitzgerald if Barney was on a bill and Ella was singing and Ray would be playing bass. And he ran in to see Ray play this club on Pico. And the manager said, oh, Ray's taking five. He's just done a set. He's got another set. And David said, okay, just tell him, you know, David Kessel was in the neighborhood, said hello. And David's walking up the street, and all of a sudden he hears this voice screaming at him, where's Barney's boy? And there's Ray with, like, a towel around him and no shirt at night running up the street to embrace David going, where's Barney's boy? So I just know that the stuff, you know, as I told you earlier, we kind of serve the music. And I just thought it was so great. And to really not complicate the web, but at this very moment, my brother, who I just talked to this morning, who's a writer and a musician himself, and he assists and collaborates with me on a couple of these books already, and we're doing another book together. My brother at this very moment is researching and writing the authorized book on Weather Report, and Joe Zawinul of Weather Report wrote that song, Mercy, 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 that you played.
Oh, my Lord. Well, Ray is
like
going to be on the program.
Yeah, well, he's still working on the book, but the thing is, there are no accidents. We're both in tune with the music because we're in service for the music for half a century. This is
That's
the
right.
good side of the music. It's not the dark side that tabloid television and lots of books focus on.
I agree. I mean, I still miss albums, you know, and the whole the aspect of the wonderful artwork that we'd see on out. The kids miss so much.
Well, I did something
and now
on
with
this
the
Doors.
Download,
yeah, and let me tell you, I did something on this Doors book, and you'll catch it when you dive into the book. Is I do miss vinyl, even though there's a 130% increase in sales of vinyl the last few years. And I do like the romantic aspect of vinyl because you have to be sort of seated to play it with people or by yourself. There's a an aspect of collaboration, i.e. record player, needle, you know, stationary, or if you're on your back or something. But the interesting thing about kind of where this is going is sort of like I got really tired of the small print of CD reissues where you could hardly read the liner notes, right? Because they and I know it's you know what I'm talking about. So I made a conscious decision in the Cave Hollywood collection and on the Doors book to use a slightly bigger font as far as the typesetting for the words in the book. And it's sort of like when you go for an eye exam and your eyes are working fine, okay? But when the when the optometrist says, "What about this?" you go look at the eye chart and all of a sudden that E thing becomes really big in front of you. And I think I think you can check out the wordage and the type and the text and the Doors books and this other book where it's easier to read and digest, and what I'm finding out, just based on phone calls and emails and a few fans that have come up to me and recognize me, they really relish the bigger print because psychologically, since everybody's on their phones all the time or on an iPod, you know, ruining their vision with that squishy print, when they are dealt with slightly bigger print, like a bigger print on a menu, shall we say, psychologically, your mind travels further when you see something bigger and clearer. That's what I think, and I think it brings us further into my books, even the aspect of the type and the font used. Maybe you won't feel that way, but that's another reason why we miss the booklets and the back of an album cover that really spelled out the credits, the songwriters, the publishing administration, and the engineers and all that. And now we're in something, I coined this word in 2009, and I mentioned it before, and Graham Nash, when he sees me on occasion, always kind of laughs because he digs it. I came up with this term because it was used as a chapter title in my Laurel Canyon book, Canyon of Dreams, and this profile of Graham Nash, where I would call the reissues and the re-releases and the box sets coming out of material reissue tissue. Not bad, right? And
perfect.
The thing is, in reissue tissue, which is fine, I'm all for dormant things having a second and third or fourth shelf life, but I don't like the liner notes often being dismissed now for cost or budget concerns. I don't like when double albums all of a sudden or they cut off some tracks. But more important, I am noticing a trend that's been going on for many years, and the late, great producer Nick Vinay and I talked about this, who produced the first few Beach Boy albums and worked with Jon Stewart and Chris Darrow and so many people. He signed the Beach Boys to their Capitol Records deal after a stint on Candix Records. You start seeing these new albums coming out in reissue form. And the reissue producers, or the people that have prepared the new configuration, their names are just as big as the original people who physically produced the original recordings. Or they'll take people's names out of the liner notes or the credits on a reissue if something goes to vinyl that came out on CD or vice versa. So I'm all for people getting acknowledged who've done their work. And if you look at my books, and you've got a half a dozen of the 12 or 14, you see how many people are thanked and acknowledged and cited. And that's another reason why I think, you know, people are warming up to my catalog and really plugging in. But I think the new font used is just a size bigger. Nobody has to keep reaching for their reading glasses to go check this stuff out.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah.
When you mentioned that, I have to open up the Doors book, and you're right, because it, yes, absolutely.
Could you just see it just off the top of your head that it's just slightly a little different?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it is, and like we were when we had our little get together last night, and I took the Doors book with me and gloated as I said, "Hey, my friend Harvey Kubernick's going to be on my show tomorrow, and here's his new book." And they were just kind of sitting there with their jaws open. And my one friend, who's quite the Doors fanatic, he goes, "Wow, I have to read that." I said, "I'll tell you what I'm so impressed with. There's not many pictures." So it's if you're an enthusiast for the Doors Summer's Gone, you need to go buy it. I'm telling you, folks, you buy it, B-U-Y-I-T, today.
Boy, I had to take you on the road as my advance man. I mean,
Al Jardine told me that
one time, too. Wow, these books mean a lot to me, and I know they mean a lot to the people who invest in them. And one little hidden pleasure I get on this Doors book, and it's only been out for a month, I'm up to about 6 or 7 people. Now, I don't know if that's a little or a lot, and I just came from a record swap meet in Pasadena, California, of, you know, rare records and thrift store kind of stuff. And I had a handful of people come up to me, because it's only like once a month, and, you know, we're all record geeks, you know.
Sure.
They all came up to me and said, "You know, I really didn't want to buy your Doors book. I've got half a dozen books on the Doors. But somebody had a copy. They just got a copy, and I looked at it, and I didn't recognize 3/4 of the names in the table of contents." And I said, "Yes." I said, "What did you do?" And he said, "I ordered 2 copies." I said, "Okay."
Well, that's right.
Because we do live in a very cynical, pessimistic society. And if you say Doors to people, "Oh, they're so overrated. They've been over-documented. Who needs it? What's he going to bring? What, you know, he never saw the band." Well, I did. "He doesn't really know them." Yes, I did. I do. And, you know, that's just human nature. We don't live in our participation society anymore, where people like you and I were seekers in the 50s and 60s as kids or teenagers, just devouring any and all things hurled at us. Now there's a bit of more due to economics, or just everybody is so overwhelmed by the amount of media tossed at them. Like, do we really need another Doors book? But I wouldn't have done this if I didn't bring in hundreds of new facts and dozens of different slants. And so when I'm here, I am at a record swap meet. You know, I love the Doors, but, you know, I didn't want to buy another Doors book. And now the guy's buying 2 of them. But part of it was, all you have to do is look at the table of contents or the dedications, and you're in for a different kind of ride. And I don't hide the fact that some of these interviews with the Doors members, the first one was conducted in 1974.
Oh, my.
Okay, now I just didn't jump on this Doors bandwagon. I've been there. I saw the group live in 1968, as early as 1972, when I was sort of a teaching assistant at San Diego State in a literature program, the first accredited literature program that studied rock lyrics, and it was mentioned in Billboard as well, Billboard magazine. I put Jim Morrison's Lords and New Creatures poetry book on the curriculum list. This stuff
Absolutely.
Goes back 47 years. You know, I know these people. I've been in some of their homes, and this is all very personal stuff to me. Part of it is I'm also dislodging an archive that I knew could work in a book and not just a slew of online articles or occasional stuff. I knew I had some really cool stuff here, and somehow, due to fate or karma or destiny or luck, my parents, my brother, I don't know what it is, but I'm in a position right now where I don't have to ask permission to do books. It's taken a very long time. If I want to do a book on my archive online pieces, I can. If I want to do a book on the Doors, I can. If I want to do a book on the Summer of Love, I'll do it, and some of the time people join with me and publish it. So I'm in a somehow in a situation where I can co-own a publishing company or be very involved in all aspects of production and assembly and writing it and doing all the legal clearance mishigas stuff. Or there are other record companies and that are starting publishing divisions or book companies, you know, that are, you know, involved with, you know, venues like Barnes & Noble, who ask me to do books for them or with them. So, I'm very fortunate because the central belief was, and this is true of any rock and roll band or any musician, there's a time when they're the only person who thinks, I can make a record, I can play a concert, I think I can get on the radio, and it all starts with yourself. I had to believe an extra 20 years that my catalog would one day have this, I can't even call it a renaissance. I mean, personally, and I write about this in the prologue to the Doors book, and I mean, I hate to be Mr. Braggart, but that's, I'm on the radio, you're asking me.
That's
I made
right.
it a point to point it to stress this in the prologue of the book, that there were enough fans and friends of mine coming up to me, partially due to the web and the internet, asking me about old articles that I had written 10, 20, 30, and 40 years ago that get circulated either through fan clubs or portals or websites or, you know, how the internet has developed where if you dig
right.
the Doors, there's 5,000 other people that like the Doors and 400 of them have their own website on the Doors. You know that community that exists.
Yeah.
And I had enough people say, well, have you done other interviews with the Doors or did you ever see them live? And it isn't like I thought this stuff didn't have a second or third life. I have been consciously trying to get a book deal for long before 2002. I was not obsessed or possessed by it. Every few months I would send out a proposal all through the 80s and well through the 90s of here's an anthology I think could work, or here's a collection of interviews with members of Love and the Doors and the Beach Boys. I would sometimes make them my three of my favorite groups together, and that concept that never even got to first base, you know,
no.
because people just couldn't under, of course, in your life and your record collection and your mixtape, all those groups all play and blend together quite nicely, don't they?
Oh yeah,
the
Arthur
public,
Lee,
public,
I'll tell you.
Of course, but I made it a point, you know, to stress this in the prologue that there was, you know, I didn't think the Doors were played out, but enough people said this stuff can work in a book. And I thought it over, and it got put together, just like the Cave Hollywood thing where David Kessel said, we're at the 10-year mark here. Let's do something that doesn't happen too often. Let's take online content and turn it into a physical hardcover book. Usually the book comes out and somebody does an excerpt in a magazine or online. You know what I'm talking about. So
sure.
We like to go the other way because people like David and I, you know, the real secret of Harvey Kubernick, and it's never really been printed, but the key thing is why the books, I think, are successful and they really throb, is that I really do think like a musician, and nobody really understands. I did dozens and dozens of sessions, largely as a percussionist or hand clap or tambourine and stuff like that. But I've been around many, many recording studios in Hollywood for 45 years. All my friends, or most of my friends, are musicians. A dozen of them are in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So I, through osmosis, and the fact is I was in bands very briefly in the mid-60s, but there are always too many jerks in the group, that I just know how to think like a musician and communicate with the people I work with like a musician. And therefore, there's a musicality in these books. Plus, for 11 and a half months, I really was West Coast Director of A&R for MCA Records. I made some very key A&R decisions that changed history there. So I have lived in that corporate world, putting people in groups, suggesting people to be signed. So I think that's part of the fabric why these books are different than a lot of other people who write books, sometimes on the same subject. They just didn't live my life. They weren't A&R people on salary. They didn't work at Gold Star Studios. They didn't, for the most part, see The Doors or Jimi Hendrix or the Beach Boys or anybody in the 60s. And I'm not saying I'm different or better, but I do know it's a whole different enchilada when I cook up, you know, when I do the cooking.
Well, one aspect you did not bring up, when I pick up these books that I have from your collection, there's one key word that just kind of stabs you right in the face. Love. There's so much love put in these books. You can see the compassion that Harvey Kubernick has put into every one of these books. The time, the sweat. And I am so impressed every time I crack one of these books open and have a chance to look through it for the first time that it will be said that Harvey Kubernick is one of the premier rock and roll historians. And we are so blessed that you have decided to take this on as a career. And anyone that's interested in rock and roll history, if they have not read a Harvey Kubernick book, they're not really enthusiasts. That's just the bottom line. What
God,
a great guest, Dr. Day.
Can you be my booking agent? I've never had one. And I'll tell you another little, I won't say secret, but backstory of why these books resonate a little deeper to you, and I appreciate, your compliments greatly. But there are moments in these books, and I'm talking about in the preliminary, we'll use the word negotiations with companies or middle people, not as much when I'm involved in ownership or co-ownership of manuscript and stuff like that. 99% of the time, I took, sometimes there was no choice, but 99% of the time, honestly, I would accept, shall we say, less advance monies to initiate the deal, and more monies earmarked for graphics and photo budget stuff.
Yeah.
I'm not bragging about this. I'm sort of answering, I'm giving you a little insight that I would rather earmark a bit more money for a larger photo budget or a color back cover, and it comes out of my own pocket or in royalties in the future. But just about every decision on every book I had anything to do with, when I could, I just chose the art over the economics. And sometimes it was a decision that wasn't super popular. Not that I have to answer to anybody, but the books have got to feel and look good. And I know the rewards are, like, for example, the Leonard Cohen book is now out in paperback. When I did the Laurel Canyon of Dreams book, and I know we talked about that on your show many years ago, and it's the book that I'm actually asked about the most and signed the most, although I think this Doors book will replace it because it's the Doors. I didn't think when I did a coffee table book, the Canyon of Dreams book, and by the way, I found every photo, every artifact, did the clearances, just like I have to find this stuff, and that's not just stock photos. I think you know I search around the world to get rarities no one's ever seen. I was pleasantly surprised 2 years ago when the publisher put out a paperback edition of the Canyon of Dreams book. Same, just a smaller size and a soft cover. And I did not plan for that, and that showed me that it could work in other formats. I wasn't thinking Leonard Cohen, it would be out in six countries, in Japan or China and Russia, same with Neil Young. Non-English speaking countries are publishing these
sure.
books. I was not even thinking of the global market. Or with Leonard Cohen, there's editions in Canada in French and in English because of the bilingual nature of the country. And so I think when you – of course, the best compliment I got on the Canyon of Dreams book, and I'll use the word compliment, when I knew it really – one of the most warmest moments when you get feedback when you do this stuff – a disc jockey sent me a long handwritten personal letter on her stationery, not from the station, and I've never met this person or talked to them on the phone or ever met them. And I actually kept this note, and she said, "I want you to know I'm in the maternity ward reading your Canyon of Dreams book before my delivery."
Oh, man.
And I said, "Wow, that is really... That was a pretty heavy." Of course, I tried to get on a radio show. Never heard from her, but and they didn't have guests on her slot, by the way. But
no.
The thing is, it really showed me something. And then when I started seeing these books go to paperback, one of the publishers said to me, "Well, people carry these items on airplanes. You can't schlep these big monsters on airplanes. They eat up too much space in your travel bag." And I wasn't even thinking of the paperback aspect of this. And the only thing I demand in the paperbacks is that the same photos and the same words get used, and we don't make abridged editions and stuff like that, although there's some Kindle stuff out there that people are now buying it. My focus is on the art and the music. I know everybody likes to say that, but I'll defy anybody who doesn't feel that in my books. Do I like the income? By the way, do I like the income streams when they somehow show up? Yes. Do I just where it used to be something I would cobble out a survival living with, has now evolved into kind of a mission, and now it's becoming, I guess, a vocation. But I do know if I just, I help a lot of people with these books. When I say help, through these books, they may find a record or a song that brings them through crisis or renewal. I get enough fan mail that I know that people take a look at this stuff and they just aren't going, "Well, I think the Doors are cool." I know that people are going to be finding a Doors record, or even if it's through a streaming service, that they'll rediscover some songs by Jim and Ray and Robbie and John. Or they may find out about who the producer Paul Rothchild is, or the engineer Bruce Botnick is, or they may discover the couple of books that Jack Holzman, the founder and owner of Elektra Records, wrote, a fucking genius visionary who started Elektra Records and changed the whole goddamn game as an independent force. And just maybe the rewards are where the books point people to.
Well,
I'm very happy about that.
And absolutely a wonderful guest. Dr. Day, what can I say?
Well, as we knew coming into this,
God bless Harvey Kubernick, and God bless our audience and SRI Records, the SRIRecords.com, a fantastic label group. You've been listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on this magical network we call Blog Talk Radio. Good night, everybody.
Come on, baby, light my fire.
Wow.